Services will be here today to answer questions, and then we'll be taking some testimony. Before I start, maybe I can just see if there are any other questions from members of the committee or others in the legislature. Well, then I have a few questions. Mr. Tesner, I think the previous time before this week when you and Dr. Sulik were here to testify or to give us an update on your plan, I asked you if the federal funds that you expected your plan to generate had been placed into the forecast. And you said they hadn't been, but then corrected yourself in my office a few days later by indicating that it had been placed into the forecast. And so we're wondering how much that is that was forecasted to be generated in federal funding because of this reorganization as compared to how much has been in the past general fund due to earnings of state-operated services.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's a sheet that's out. It's kind of it's entitled Impacts to Revenue that I'll be speaking from. And looking at this sheet, the closure of the Mankato Crisis Center and the shift of that service to the St. Peter CBHH was one of the areas where the revenues are already booked. Already in the forecast, if you will. The St. Peter CBHH is expected to be running, I believe, at a 14 average daily census, and the revenues attributed to that were already in the forecast. The actual census is running somewhere closer to between 8 and 10. So even though we're expecting to be able to collect on those, the revenue forecast already includes those revenues.
And how much is it?
Madam Chair, I don't have that figure in front of me today. I can give you an approximate, and we can get you the details on what that exact projection is.
Okay, what is it approximately?
The CBHH operation is approximately on average about $3.5 million a year, and we project, I believe, about 85% of that in terms of collections.
So that would be federal funds, 85% of $3.5
million? From the previous slides that we talked about earlier this week, MA accounts for, so we don't have that here, I think MA, federal funding accounts for, I think, about 60% of our revenues in the CBHHs that are certified.
So how much is that?
Well, it would be 60% of 85%. Senator, I'm kind of out there on the end of a limb. I'd prefer to get you the details in specific. But the basic facts are we expect to collect in the St. Peter program. The addition of the Mankato services in there will not change the revenues we forecasted because we already expected that program to run essentially full. And I'll get you the specific figures on that.
Are any of the certified programs the ones that are scheduled to be closed?
They are not.
Okay.
The transition of
then
one.
Then are any of the programs that are being converted to other services going to be collecting federal funding?
The Eveleth program, which right now does not collect federal funding, will be changed into an adult foster care intensive site. That will be funded through waivered services, which will draw down federal dollars. It'll be operated on our enterprise side, so those dollars will be used to offset the cost of the operation of the program.
Okay.
The Wadena and Wilmer CBHHs, which are not certified, will be converted to PERTs. And those we're in the process of design. We're in the midst of a design process where we will be looking at the exact utilization, who will be there, how long, exact services they'll provide, which we believe then will be tailored so that they will draw down federal dollars. Same with the...
So are those federal dollars forecasted yet?
They are not.
Do you know how much they will be?
Not. We do not until we go through the design process and what the PERTs actually will look like.
Well, do you have an estimate of what you think or hope they will be?
We do not have an estimate of what we hope they will be, Senator.
Madam Chair?
Senator Lori?
This is part of phase one that's supposed to be done in 3 months. Is that correct as well?
No, these two are phase one, step two. I don't know if that makes a difference as to the timing, but... this is a finance committee, and we're supposed to be, you know, revising the state budget for this biennium. And I just, you know, I find this pretty difficult to believe that we're on a fast track to do this permanent change, which will have fairly dramatic effects on the services and the system, without knowing what we're going to be having in terms of funding for it.
Madam Chair, I think John Zakel is here today and may be able to shed some light on the process to achieve federal funding for the PERTs, if it would be helpful.
Well, anything you can tell us might be.
Madam Chair, John Zakel from DHS. Madam Chair, the amount of federal funding that we can get will depend on the design of these services. And as Dr. Sulik said earlier, that's a design that's still being refined to make sure it'll meet the needs. There are four work groups that were described that will help develop the details of what these new PERTs are going to be. And then we'll figure out how much that's going to require a change in our Medicaid state plan and exactly how that's going to work then with the federal reimbursement. There were some very broad estimates that were developed back as part of the unallotment process. And here we need to check back with our state operated services chief financial officer in terms of exactly how much was already booked as part of the unallotment process, but I know that there were some revenues that were already counted there.
Well, we want to have all of your financial documents about all of this. Is there anyone here from finance?
Madam Chair.
Senator.
Thank you. Are any of the CBHHs still trying to get certification or being allowed to go through certification?
Madam Chair, Senator, we will be moving to seek certification. Currently, there's four CBHHs that are certified. All those that will maintain their CBHH status will be moving to get them certified. We've had problems getting the federal government to cooperate with that process, although we are optimistic that they will be back and doing their surveys. At the same time, we are looking at this new collaborative partnership model with hospitals, mental health centers, primary care clinics. So it is conceivable that there may be a certification achieved through those partnerships. For example, if we were to become a hospital inside a hospital and operate inside of an existing licensed CMS-certified structure, that would negate the need for us to have special certification or certification as an independent hospital. So those partnership discussions will begin this summer, hopefully having them concluded within the next 15 months. So in the event that the feds have not come and surveyed the hospitals, that might be another avenue to get them certified.
So follow-up, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
They are in the process of getting everyone certified?
We are.
I heard a lot of ifs and buts and hopes and dreams. Madam Chair, I'm concerned that we're going down a road before we we're getting some pieces ahead of other pieces here, and you're not getting financial questions answered. I'm looking at potential job losses in my district and service losses in my district, and I'm curious how we're cobbling this together. And I know I don't sit on this committee, but I appreciate the invitation to be here today.
Sure. Well, we did have earlier in the week an entire presentation, and
they are in the process of getting me the was that a
it looks like this.
Michael. Okay, appreciate that.
Senator Rosen isn't here today, so maybe we can let you look at her material until we get you your own.
Am I asking questions, Madam Chair, that we've already covered?
No, no, that's fine. We barely started asking questions about it because it
thank you.
We did ask a few along the way, but we didn't finish asking questions. So,
Mr. Tessner, do you understand my concern here? I mean, the chair has asked you some financial questions. Wadena has, on several occasions, asked me about accelerating their certification. Nothing ever seems to move forward. And now we're proposing changes without answering the questions. And I think we're putting some clients in jeopardy and certainly some employees.
Madam Chair, Senator, the specific changes around Wadena are driven by the current utilization pattern, which has been consistent for about the last 3 years. Wadena's average daily census has run between 6 and 8. It's a license for 16 beds. About half the folks in that program on any given day don't need hospital-level care. They need something more than what's available in the community, but they don't need hospital-level care. So by going from a hospital license to a PERT, what that allows us to do is serve many of, if not most of the folks that currently are utilizing that service and to achieve a savings. This redesign is not driven solely by the $17 million budget pressure that we have, but that is a factor in our decisions on how to adjust our system.
Well, Mr. Tessner, that may be true, but we seem to be making some arbitrary decisions without having the full impact of both the services and financials.
Madam Chair, Senator, what is unclear to us at this point is the amount of revenue that we will generate in this new system. We are designing it specifically so it will generate more revenue than what we're currently achieving. And it's also being designed so that it is responsive to the needs of the folks that are coming in the door and the numbers of folks coming in the door. So we do know what we're going to be saving and the operation of the system once it's redesigned. What we don't know is the kind of revenues that will be generated in the services that we don't quite yet have the design complete, nor, as Mr. Zakel has said, do we have the necessary approval, perhaps, to draw down the federal dollars. So it is unclear for the things that aren't quite completely designed and in place what those revenues will be. But for the services that we currently have, we know what the savings will be. And the services that are currently certified, we know what those collections will be.
Mr. Tessner, Madam Chair, if I could just ask one more question,
sure,
about the, especially about the Wadena facility. Is part of the projected savings involve breaking the contract with the hospital?
Madam Chair, Senator, it is not.
Mr. Tessner, maybe we could just get a little better description of what a PERT would be. Is it a residential program with intensive outpatient treatment services being offered through a clinic type of program? Is that what it's envisioned to be? What you have in this little handout describing it is pretty vague.
Madam Chair, The description on that page is not as full and as rich as it needs to be to actually describe the service. We have done some preliminary work on what we believe that needs to be. But let me back up. The advent of the PERT idea comes from our careful evaluation of our utilization. The patients coming in the door, the folks who get stuck in the hospital and that cannot be discharged because the level and intensity of treatment and support they need in the community doesn't exist. So, if you will, the PERT is essentially intended to be a service that will fill a gap that right now does not have a service in it. It is less than a hospital level of care, so it is not the folks that would benefit from this service do not need to be seen by their psychiatrist on a daily basis in the hospital. We anticipate that the acuity and the intensity of their symptoms is probably higher than what is available to be supported in the community. So it will have 24-hour psychiatric on-call services. It will have a psychiatrist available to round on it probably weekly. It will have a full array of services probably similar to partial hospitalization services, so 5 to 7 hours a day of active treatment and supervision and monitoring of nursing staff overnight. So it will have, if you will, somewhat of a step-down feel from a hospital level of care.
Well, would it be more like an ERTS than what I just described, or would it be more like what I just described?
Madam Chair, it will be more intense than an ERT. The ERT system, as it currently exists today, is not capable of moving these folks back because of the acuity that they still present. So it is going to be more intense than an ERT level of care, less intense than a hospital level of care.
Well, then I might just ask the question, how do we know that this service will be able to get certified for Medicaid reimbursement by the federal government? Is it going to look like anything anybody else has anywhere that gets Medicaid funding?
Madam Chair, the current structure for adult intensive residential treatment is fairly flexible in terms of how much intensity is included there. And I'm hopeful that that's basic structure will give us a basis to get federal reimbursement for this new PERT category.
Would the service that gets the reimbursement be considered clinic type services?
Madam Chair, I believe it would qualify under the Medicaid rehab option.
Rehab option. Okay. But it wouldn't look like our other rehab option services that we have thus far.
Madam Chair, as Mr. Tessner said, it would be kind of like an ERTS, but more intensive. So I think that's, at this point, that's how I'm thinking about it, is that it would be very similar in terms of the basic structure in which federal category it would come under, but quite a bit more intensive than the current ERTS.
But would it be billing like an ERTS does today?
Madam Chair, yes.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Laurie.
It would be licensed as an ERT then, too? I mean, you said that it was, you know, that the ERT rules are fairly broad in how you can do it. So it would be licensed like an ERT and billing like an ERT. Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Laurie, that is one of the important questions that we would still have to work out.
Is there another license category you're contemplating?
Madam Chair, Senator Lurie, the ERTS category is currently, I think it's technically referred to as a, I'm not sure I've got the right words, of a variance of the Rule 36 license. And so there's a potential to do a different kind of a variance of that Rule 36 license. The department has the authority under licensure laws to do that. But that's all part of what would have to be worked out as part of this design work group.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Tessner, particularly with regard to Wadena and Willmar, it sounds as if the new organization or new system of services is something less than what is currently available to those individuals now. Can you talk to us a little bit about who and how those that are being currently served are going to be reevaluated, and what happens if upon that evaluation that it is determined that that individual's needs aren't going to be met at the Wadena facility or at the Wilmer facility? And if you could also, I think it might help us in our ongoing discussion, you've indicated to us when you were here last that step one of this is to happen in 3 months. And it might be helpful for us to know when the 3 months started or starts.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, in terms of the first part of your question regarding the modification of the current Wadena and Wilmer sites from a hospital to a PERT, as I had alluded to earlier, many of the folks who need that level of service now would continue to go there. The folks who need acute inpatient psychiatric care, which they will not be able to get at those sites, they would be able to access them through the other CBHHs. So in the Wilmer area, the closest alternative would be Alexandria, which is about an hour drive. In the Wadena area, it's either Alexandria or Brainerd, both of which are within about an hour's drive. We realize that this does, in fact, create a distance issue for some of the folks that could now go to those CBHHs. However, in order to achieve the budget savings, we had to make decisions about changing the system and the way that it's accessed. What we're hopeful in the long run is with this redesign, partnering with hospitals and looking at psychiatric level 1, level 2, and PERTs as a system of care, that we will be able to enhance the access across the state region by region. We don't know, as we talked earlier this week, we don't quite know what those look like yet, but it is our intent to fashion those that are sensitive to these issues around geography and access to psychiatric inpatient versus PERT level 1, level 2 in each region to make sure that that region is optimizing all of its resources, not just the CBHHs, not just the PERTs, not just what SOS does, but what we do as a provider in conjunction, in partnership with that broader set of services. The second part of your question was the timing of the next 90 days. We began that process with our bargaining units a couple weeks back. Now, so the initial changes will begin, I believe, on April 9th with notification of staff who will be impacted by these changes and will be completed by the end of April, first part of May. Additionally to that, the changes out of Anoka and the Cambridge MEDO program and the Brainerd MNS are probably running 30 days or more behind that because we have the legislative no layoff provision that we need to work through because the no layoff provision presents an obstacle for us in that redesign.
Madam Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You have more acronyms in here than I think they do in K-12. I'm not exactly sure if I understand what's going on, but and the proposed plan might be a really good proposed plan. I don't know. My problem is that it's been sprung on us, and closing Eveleth on May 1st is definitely problematic. And I would think that these other places that are suddenly finding out that there's going to be closure and people are going to be losing jobs and services are going somewhere else are problematic. And the more I hear about Eveleth, the more concerned I get because we talked the last time I was in here, and this is now my second meeting here, that closing the mental health unit in Eveleth has ramifications with the clinic, the nursing home, and the dialysis unit because of the way the monies flow through the city of Eveleth and from the SOS. And the now we're hearing, though, that if, in fact, the mental health unit closes and these monies aren't allowed to flow, that we have problems with the drugstore, we have problems with the dairy, and we have problems with the laundry in town. And these are things that I think we need time to deal with if, in fact, this is going to happen. So I don't know how we slow this train down, Madam Chair, but I think somewhere along the way here that these timelines either have to be moved out, or we have to find some money to avert the issue that's happening. I'm very, very concerned about what happens, and if there are transitions that are potential solutions to these closures, then I think the transitions have to be in place before the closures happen, so that we can actually see that the zero-sum game that we're trying to get to is actually going to happen.
Mr. Tesner, what legislative action do you anticipate needing to have us take in order for this plan to be able to move forward and be implemented?
Madam Chair, the primary area, the single area that I'm aware of has to do with the no layoff language around the reorganization of MITO and the reorganization of the Anoka Hospital.
And that is because, I mean, you can do all the rest of this without us saying yes, no, or maybe, because?
Madam Chair, we believe that we can take the other actions, and I guess we can walk through them based upon our assessment of the utilization of the needs of the folks that we're serving. This is not terribly dissimilar, although it certainly is much larger of scope than what we would have typically done. But we have modified programs, downsized programs in the past in very similar ways. This is much broader and more intricate than other changes we've made, but it's very similar.
So what would you do differently in your plan if the legislature does not make the cut that was proposed in the governor's supplemental budget this year?
Madam Chair, I think you're referencing the $2.2 million, if I'm recalling the number correctly, that was allocated to the state-operated services in the governor's proposed budget. I think that's the figure.
Well, we can look in here and find it.
It's on page 8 of the... It's on page 8 of the
2.2110.
And it's, you know, that is on, of course, because it's a proposal, it has been highlighted. If that does not occur, then we could, we would have more flexibility in the timing of many of these changes. Right now, our approach is to include that, anticipating that it may very well occur in some fashion.
Only thing that would change is the timing. I thought part of the reason, and maybe even most of the reason that this is happening, is because of a $17 million shortfall that would otherwise occur in your budget.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry if I'm not being clear. We went through an elaborate process analyzing over the last couple of years now the utilization of our hospital system. The impact that it has on the patients that we serve, the disconnects that are there, the people that can't get access to the right level of care, people that get stuck in emergency departments, in our own hospitals, in the NeuroRehab, Minnesota NeuroRehab Hospital and the MITO program, where people need access to the right level of care and can't get there because we as the state-operated services provider don't have that array of services available. So this redesign is being driven to the largest extent by a realization on our part that the current array of services we have do not adequately meet the needs of the people coming to our door for care. Now, the timing of those services and the configuration of them is certainly driven by the $17 million budget pressure. But if that budget pressure changes, it doesn't change the impact of the current system design on the folks that we serve. We would still need to adjust the way that we do services. It would substantially change the timing if these pressures weren't here. We could have more time to address the kind of concerns that Senator Tomasini is raising about the impact of the array of businesses, healthcare services in Eveleth, which we're sensitive to, but with the timing that is in front of us, given the budget pressures, we haven't done things in a way that has allowed some of the conversations that we're now having on how to minimize those impacts.
Are there other questions? Senator Prettner-Sullen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to say that while I realize there are problems in the districts and that there are a number of adjustments that need to be made, I'm actually very impressed with the plan and feel that it will provide a much more efficient continuum of care for the patient, and that the patient is going to feel less of a disruption as they're moving through their recovery process and the supports that are going to be available. I like what I hear. I realize that it means a different way of addressing the problem here. But I think that it also, from a revenue standpoint, we'll be filling those slots better, and so we'll have less losses in our system than we currently have. And as I said, I know that there are problems in the districts that need to be accounted for, but the design, I think, is visionary, and I like it.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the 15 pages of acronyms that we were handed now so we can follow along better. But
well, you have to also understand there are new ones being invented as we speak.
Appreciate that. I look forward to the updated copy then. Mr. Tester, I have another committee, so I'm going to jump ahead a little bit here, but could you discuss briefly the desire to close the three dental facilities in this plan and your plan to serve those clients?
Well, the plan is actually to close them all, just over time, just so you're clear on that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator, the rest of the committee members, but I need to give a little bit of background, which I'm sure you've already heard. We began running community-based dental clinics in the early 90s at the advent of the closure of the developmental disability institutions to fill a gap that was there. Over the course, the funding strategy for that at the time was to collect all the revenues we could and then offset those collections with a state appropriation from those institutions. That strategy worked up until the last several years, because as those institutions left, no money was held in reserve to fund the dental clinics. It was taken either to provide adult mental health services in other ways, or it became part of the savings it became savings to the state in some fashion. So at this point, we are operating five clinics, serving about 5,500 individuals. 5,500 contacts per year, sometimes multiple contacts. We are targeting primarily individuals that have limited access to dental care. Most of the folks are folks with developmental disabilities that present to other dental clinics in ways that they're not able or willing to serve them. Last year, we brought forward a legislative proposal to fully fund those dental clinics. There were other priorities that perhaps were more important, but that was not fully funded. It represents a $2.6 million budget pressure against our system. In looking at the $17 million that we have to address, what we are proposing is to focus most clearly on our highest priority, which is providing services for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, cognitive disorders through traumatic brain injury, and not dental services. We realize this presents a stress because our plan is to initiate the closures of the dental clinics at Cambridge, Wilmer, and Fergus Falls, maintaining capacity at Brainerd and at the clinic in Faribault, but actively seek an alternative way for those dental services to be provided so that we can get out from underneath that budget pressure. What it's causing us to do is provide less services to the primary purpose for state-operated services. As Dr. Sulik had alluded earlier, if this committee feels that state-operated services should be a dental clinic, then we have to be in conversation about how to do that and how to fund it. Because right now we are not able to maintain that without the potential of closing other services that, frankly, we believe are more important.
And
so I think maybe we should just give you our version of what happened so that you don't leave here with the misimpression that this committee acted irresponsibly in regard to these dental services. We believe that the dental services that we were providing could draw more federal funding than they were getting. And so we wrote into the budget bill last year mechanisms for them to do that. And it did generate more money for the clinics than they had otherwise in their budget. Now, subsequent to the legislature adjourning, the governor unallotted the Critical Access Dental Program, which was part of the money that these dental clinics were to receive. So to say that the legislature failed to fund these programs and therefore there are budget pressures that are causing them to close, I think is a bit of a misrepresentation.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the explanation, but my follow-up would be then, how are we going to serve these individuals? They do not go away. Some of my constituents will now have a four-hour round trip to receive those services with developmentally disabled children that they are raising at home. I personally am dental phobic. If I have a person in the waiting room, I break into a sweat when I walk in the building. And if I have a person in the waiting room with a helmet on that is screaming already, I am having a difficult time going to the dentist at that point. I have disabled individuals that need four, five, or six cleanings a year because of other circumstances that they're dealing with. And I don't know. There's got to be a better way. Well, I guess the question is, how are we going to serve them?
Madam Chair, Senator, we are going to maintain capacity at the Brainerd Dental Clinic and at the Faribault Clinic. And
how long?
Until we can find an alternative provider.
That wasn't what we were told last meeting. We were told that that would be until the end of the biennium, and then those services also would be closed. I think it's in here someplace.
Our intent is to have a different, an alternative strategy for serving them by the end of the biennium.
Right, but we don't know what it is. I mean, you know, there was a suggestion that federally qualified clinics could take over, but I have one of those in my district, and they're turning away people who are not disabled, who previously were served by that clinic because of unallotments and budget cuts that have been made by the governor. So, you know, I don't have a lot of optimism about this idea that somehow there's a magic answer out there in the community that we haven't found for meeting more of our clients' dental needs. We see the ability to meet the needs of people shrinking. Not growing. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would agree with the Chair's comments that whether it's the disability community or not, I know that there are dental access issues across every district in the state of Minnesota. And members, this conversation is so ironic because as we speak right now, we are in year two of a grant that Minnesota received to take care of and discuss an overall oral health plan for the state of Minnesota. We're spending $330,000 this year to figure out how to implement and develop an oral health plan for the state of Minnesota. That's through the Department of Health. So when sometimes we talk about, Senator Sharon Alvarez often talks about silos or, you know, does this side know what this side is doing. I think this is a great example. In fact, as a part of this grant, one of the components includes hiring staff, including a dental director. Now, how silly is it that we're going to be entertaining a thought of hiring a dental director at the same time that we're closing down and shutting down every conceivable public health dental service that we have? And I would hope, as you're struggling to get out under this budget pressure, it bothers me that we're having so much focus on the budget pressure. I think the focus should be on the services that Minnesotans expect and deserve. But do know that your counterpart in the Department of Health is working on an overall oral health plan, and I just think there's a huge, huge, unacceptable disconnect here.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, we'll follow up on that expeditiously. I do want to emphasize we have had conversations with alternative ways of doing this. The University of Minnesota Dental School, Dr. Patrick Lloyd is the dean. They have opened several clinics in Minnesota, one in Hibbing, one in Willmar, that are serving underserved populations. These conversations occurred before the last summer, before the size and scope of the budget pressures were realized. But there are some creative ideas out there, and it is our intent to follow up with those, including getting in closer contact with the Department of Health about this to see if there's a way to do this without dropping out of the business completely. But I want to emphasize, we don't see this as core to our mission, given the potential. We're projecting to save 1.4 million of the 17 of this by getting out of these three dental clinics and consolidating the services in two sites. For lack of that, that means 1.4 million has to come from someplace else in our system. That's literally the decision making that we have to do. And to your point about addressing the needs of the folks that we're to serve, we believe we're doing that. Our intent is to redesign a system and move to a much more effective and efficient way to support the people that come to our door. I don't at all discount the discomfort that it creates in the communities that we're changing our services, the discomfort for our employees that are going to be impacted by this. But we have an obligation to first and foremost serve the people that come to our door in the most effective way possible, and to meet our budgetary constraints.
Mr. Tesmer, I just have one comment to your answer to Senator Lynch, and that is, last summer when I talked with Dr. Lloyd, he told me that they would be discontinuing services to adults in a big way because of the governor's unallotment of critical access dental. That hit their budget very hard also. So how they take over more of the clients that you're talking about seems to me hard to understand. It's like somebody else has a pot of gold here that we don't know about. I don't think so. The unallotment of critical access dental by the governor was a big mistake. And, you know, I don't know what we can do about it at this point in time. You know, we're all kind of sitting around waiting for the lawsuit, but I can tell you this much. It affected more than just state-operated services' ability to serve clients that we are obliged to provide services to. And if you think that you're going to be able to operate state-operated services group homes for people with developmental disabilities that are not able to get dental services, think again. Senator Sharon?
Thank you. I just have a couple of questions. I'm not really enjoying this conversation, and I guess I should start by saying positives. I do think redesign is important, and that there are gaps that we can fill by better designing, and that the long-term vision is very exciting. And I just believe that that we can't be throwing out solutions that don't include the participation in creating the solution at the local level. Now, I know that in the course of this plan that there were focus groups and work groups and discussion groups about needs. But I'm clearly hearing back from my area where they're shocked, they're put into shock about the closure of the crisis center, that they were not involved in the solution, in creating the solution. Just the critical access dental care, Senator Lynch and I have been struggling with a problem of special transportation services for persons who are handicapped. And when you've got a four-hour trip that somebody's talking about and they're going to need special transportation services, the cost is going to skyrocket in terms of those kinds of costs, maybe beyond what it is that everybody's talking about saving here. And that's the kind of silos that I'm talking about that just doesn't make sense. And there's much shifting of costs in the closure of the Mankato Crisis Center to our local units of government. My question is, today, after I get back to my district, I'm meeting with leadership and stakeholders in the service of mental health services throughout my region, not just the crisis center. And it isn't discomfort, as you're describing, Mr. Tessner, that they're feeling about change. It is a very, very deep concern about being able to serve the clients. So I really want to be careful to say that it isn't that they're uncomfortable with what you've recommended because they're uncomfortable with losing jobs or change. They're very uncomfortable with the fact that there will be a huge gap in service based on a hope that the CBHH in St. Peter is going to be able to accomplish what the crisis center does now. They don't believe that, and I believe them. So today we're meeting to talk about an alternative that may be temporary alternative to what's being proposed here so that the plan can fold out a little better and consider things like geography and location and transportation costs. And I'm hoping and I'm asking you, is the department, we don't have any authority here, is the department open to an alternative that will be presented from Mankato? Pardon?
Senator Sharon, I just wanted to make it clear it doesn't mean we can't get some authority.
I hope we can get some authority, but given that this is moving so quickly, I think that we are working very hard locally, all the players from New Ulm, all the entire region, about offering an alternative that will be less expensive, but may require a grant or something from the state to help in a transition. Is there an openness to considering an alternative here?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I was aware the meeting is occurring, and we are anxious to hear what the ideas are, and we'd be happy to sit down and see what we can do. These changes are, let me reiterate, they are not intended to lessen care. They're intended to forward this broader mission, this broader vision. They are intended to do the best we can within the limited resources that we have that are further limited. It doesn't mean that we're not open to creative alternatives. We are.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, just sitting here and listening, and obviously this is everything we talk about in this committee is extremely important. And what kind of strikes me today is we've got Senator Tomasoni and Senator Scogin, and I see another senator sitting behind me. Obviously this is very important. I'm surprised that Dr. Sulik must have a good reason for not being here. I think he should be here. Not that Mr. Tessner is not capable. He's very capable. But I would just say that Dr. Sulik obviously has got an emergency that's more important than meeting with the legislature. And I think that should be pointed out to him that he should
Senator
be here.
Senator Coring, you know, we have, I think up until today, we have worked very hard to try to schedule meetings Dr. Sulik would be at, need to be at here with us around his schedule. But it has become clear that the time we have left in this session is not going to permit that, that he simply isn't going to be available when we need to be able to meet to discuss this. So I can tell him we're sorry, but that's life.
Madam Chair.
Senator.
I think I heard one more problem. And in response to Senator Lynch's question about the dental access, if Hibbing is one of the solutions, I have been told by my dentist that the lack of the critical access care money for Hibbing will cause them to not be able to serve the population that they're intended to serve.
Yes.
And so, I mean, it's starting to snowball here. And
yeah, it is not just in state-operated services that this has created a problem. It has created a problem throughout the state. And, you know, I know we've had some testimony at times from people in the department about how the critical access dental program hasn't worked. You take it down and you watch how it did work, because we will be seeing access problem after access problem. We will be seeing disabled Minnesotans that are the clients of the Department of Human Services in emergency room after emergency room. And it is disgraceful and shameful to think that we would let that happen.
And we don't have dentists in the hospitals.
No, they won't get dental care. They'll just get medications, antibiotics and pain medications. And they'll be back, and they'll be back. And imagine group homes trying to care for residents who are in such terrible pain. I have a couple of questions about Anoka, if we're done with other questions so far.
Well, Madam Chair, just before we transition there, Madam Chair, I remain a little bit confused about the authority and the jurisdiction and the magnitude of these changes. Is someone going to offer some clarification on that today, or are we seeking further counsel on that?
We have been. I don't think there's more I can say about that.
Thank you.
We made a copy. I don't know if you need one, Mr. Tesmer, but we made a copy of the law we passed last year regarding the reform of Anoka. And it's not too long. I'm going to read it. In consultation with community partners, the Commissioner of Human Services shall develop an array of community-based services to transform the current services now provided to patients at the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. The community-based services may be provided in facilities with 16 or fewer beds and must provide the appropriate level of care for the patients being admitted to the facilities. The planning for this transition must be completed by October 1st, 2009, with an initial report to the committee chairs of the Health and Human Services by November 30th, 2009, and a semi-annual report on progress until the transition is completed. And then there continues to be some language about seeking the input of stakeholders, and then there's no layoff language. You haven't done this.
Madam Chair, I believe Dr. Sulik raised this issue, and I'll revisit it. We've learned much from the application of the 16-bed model in Greater Minnesota. We've tracked very carefully its utilization, both in terms of the numbers of folks served, the characteristics of those folks, the length of stay, where they come from, where they go to, as well as all of the weaknesses of the hospital system that we operate out there. What we determined is one of the major weaknesses, and this was affirmed, and as we met with stakeholders throughout the state and including in the Twin Cities, that to operate freestanding 16-bed hospitals, to operate outside of a creative partnership, an integrated model of care, left huge gaps, which worked to the detriment of the people that we serve. What it entailed was we were saying no to people being admitted to hospitals who desperately needed something, but they didn't need a hospital. What they needed wasn't available in the community, and they ended up either stuck in an emergency department someplace or in the back of a squad car or in jail. We ended up serving people far longer than they needed to be served. So what has come out of all of these meetings statewide and in the metro area was the need for us to design a very new system, not simply replicate the 16-bed models, not simply replicating specialty hospital systems or specialty programs like MEDO, but to develop a system of care intimately woven into partnership with other hospitals, mental health centers, other health care providers, so that there was a comprehensive response to the individuals presenting, so that the general hospital that was providing or the primary health care clinic that was providing health care for individuals with disabilities had ready access to the expertise available through state-operated services and other providers to deal with their mental illness or their cognitive impairment. So our intent, after having studied this carefully, is not to simply replicate what we did in Greater Minnesota. We believe that would be a mistake.
Mr. Tesmer, I'm going to ask you to stop answering my question now. And I'm going to ask you to be very careful about how you continue to answer my question, because there are other people sitting at this table with me who were in the meetings where we discussed this legislation many times and discussed the wording of it very carefully. And at no time were we discussing replicating 16-bed hospitals. At no time were we discussing that in regard to the transformation of Anoka. We talked about ERTS, we talked about intensive outpatient services for people who would be in residential beds. We talked about dental services, even, as I recall. But never were we talking about 16-bed hospitals like we have in rural Minnesota. So would you like to start your answer over again?
Madam Chair, I apologize for the confusion that I've given you. My statement was intended to elucidate that having state-operated services operate outside of this creative partnership model, where we are working hand in glove with other providers, leaves huge gaps in the system, leaves our services ineffective because we are providing a snippet of care that people need that's not well coordinated with other providers. So our intent is to work collaboratively to invite hospitals, primary care centers, other psychiatric providers, other psychiatric hospitals, mental health centers into these creative partnership discussion so that the redesign of Anoka fits into those systems of care and is not separate from or disparate from or independent of those, but actively integrated into them. And I'm not clear at this point exactly what our role will be in that, because we have to make our role fit into those systems of care.
So are you telling me that you decided, for whatever reason, to violate this law? Is that what you're telling me?
Madam Chair, we're trying to be compliant with the law, but we're matching that up with our experience and our understanding of how the system needs to change. We believe that this direction will be far more beneficial to the people that we serve than what the current structure is, the current lack of these partnerships, lack of these creative integrated models in the Twin Cities and as well as Greater Minnesota.
Well, then let's talk about this plan. Why does this plan not even include a PERT for the metropolitan area?
Madam Chair, there may very well be PERT services in the Twin Cities, but those decisions will be made with those partners at the table. We can't be in a situation where we're replicating services that other providers are able and willing to do. So it's not clear exactly what that array of services in the Twin Cities will be run by the state. We will be working that out in these partnership discussions, so that we're ensuring that that array of services that's out there is coordinated and connected, and that we are filling in where we need to. It could very well be that we're operating acute inpatient beds or outpatient services or PERTs, that array of services that we spoke about last year. But we won't know that until we sit down with these partners and work those details out.
Well, is there a PERT available now in the Twin Cities?
Madam Chair, there is not.
So would it be outside of the scope of the role of state-operated services to be able to provide one?
Madam Chair, it is within our scope to provide that level of care.
And is it not true that there are people at Anoka that need that level of care more than they need hospitalization?
Madam Chair, that's true.
then I don't get it. I don't get why you're not following the law. The law gave you a time to meet with community partners and plan for a reorganization of services at Anoka. The law asked you to do that. The law proposed that there would be $700,000 of savings. The plan you're presenting to us doesn't do any of this and proposes $200,000 of savings. So, you know, what is very troubling to me is we appropriate the dollars that you use for your program. And up until now, you know, we've probably given you too much flexibility in how you use those dollars. But when we ask you to do something specific in regard to the money we do give you, and you just ignore it, then it becomes almost unfathomable to me how we deal with the situation that you're presenting to us. I just don't understand. What do we need to do? What more than this do we need to do?
Well, Madam Chair, let me restate. Our intent is to begin these conversations for these creative partnerships this summer and to begin within the next 15 months to implement these things. And we believe that is the strongest move that we can make in addressing the needs of the folks that are coming to us for care.
The law said you were to start that planning last May and complete it by October 1st. So why didn't that happen? And how can I believe you when you tell me, oh, sometime down the road, we're going to start doing that planning?
Well, Madam Chair, in terms of why we didn't have to hit the deadlines that were established in law, you know, we entered into a very broad planning process that included stakeholders from throughout the state, and the process took much longer than we'd anticipated, and certainly beyond the scope of what the law required.
But don't you believe that when a law like this is passed, that there should be some priority given to meeting with stakeholders and doing the planning that the law required you to do? I mean, was I on you last October? You didn't do this by October 1st? No. You said, well, we're incorporating it into all the other planning we're doing. Okay. Here you are. In March, the planning is completed, and this hasn't been done as a part of it. I believe I have every reason to be very, very angry about this. You know, I went way out on a limb to make this happen. So I'm quite disappointed in the department's inability to be responsive. And, you know, we talked about, when we worked on this legislation together, community partnerships that may be something that you're alluding to in your conversation with us today. And in those conversations, it was clear to me that it would require layoffs of employees who work at Anoka today. I mean, you said that. You were upfront with me about that. And so we didn't go that route. We went this route because this would be able to be handled without layoffs. This would be able to be handled by creating a different configuration of services. Yes, that would save money, but would not require layoffs of employees. Isn't that correct?
Madam Chair, at the time that discussion occurred, we were not fully apprised of the amount of budget pressure that we'd be under. We also had not had all the conversations with all the different stakeholders, which shaped some of our, actually shaped the plan that's in front of you today. So we know much more about exactly the issues that you're raising, which is why the time frames were not adhered to, which is why the planning is at the stage that it's in now. It wasn't a disregard for what the statute requires or a disregard of the direction or the conversations that we had with you. It was basically informed by all of these factors, which led us to this proposal and the time frame for the proposal, as well as the staffing changes that are required to do it. We simply didn't know then what we know now.
Well, be that as it may, now when you talk about, you know, you're going to start this sometime in the future, and there will be more discussion with community partners, it leads me to believe that you would be thinking about taking this in a direction where it would require layoffs of Anoka workers. And since you seem to be able to do it all on your own anyway, without the legislature's approval, why would I think otherwise?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Senator.
Well, when we talked earlier about this before this was completely finalized, the discussion was if we could develop community partnerships so that community providers could serve these patients in their facilities instead of in ours, there would be layoffs, however. Now you're talking about moving forward in terms of community partnership discussions, and it leads me to believe that perhaps that would be the direction you would be moving that would require more layoffs than even are in your plan in front of us.
Madam Chair, we are not anticipating layoffs related to the partnerships. We anticipate that we will continue to be the provider of care inside of those partnerships. Now, if our role in that service system shifts substantially, so we go from providing hospital level care to PERT level care, there wouldn't be the need for the hospital level of staffing, but it wouldn't be the partnership. Our intent is to come to the table as a provider of services, as a provider of care, and enter into those conversations as a service provider, not simply to hand services off to somebody else.
Are there any other questions? Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, this is for Mr. Tesner, and I sort of feel like this should be self-evident, but in light of the discussions this morning, I think maybe I'll just try to be very, very clear. Dr. Sulik talked when he was here before about the efforts that were made to do some community outreach and to provide, get stakeholder input as you were developing this plan. I did notice, however, that noticeably absent from your discussions were communications with the City of Alexandria, the City of Willmar, and the City of Eveleth. Ironically, those three communities arguably are the most impacted in this situation. And so I just have to wonder to what degree you understand and have communicated with those partners that already exist in those communities. Particularly, Senator Tomasoni has illustrated and talked about the unique situation that he has already in collaboration and partnership with entities there. Frankly, I think that deserves additional consideration. And I'm not confident that, as your plan has been presented, that you've done that homework. Likewise, in light of the discussions that we've had, I'm less and less comfortable with the proposal that's laid out in phase one in its entirety, because I think the discussion's been, frankly, kind of sloppy, and I don't think that you've demonstrated that you've done your homework. You've not provided us with answers, and when we've given you direction, you've blatantly disregarded it. It's very disappointing. So I would expect that before you proceed forward, particularly with those three communities, I'd like some reassurance that that's been revisited and clearly vetted.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, we have had a meeting with Senator Tomasoni yesterday with the City of Eveleth and other representatives to better understand the impact of the changes in that city. We are working towards resolving this so that it doesn't create the disruption that is potentially going to be there. We haven't reached conclusion on that yet, but we are moving forward in those conversations. I'm not sure that Alex doesn't have a change here. All right, were you referencing Wadena or Mankato? Or
Mr. Tesner, you've indicated that Alexandria is going to potentially absorb some of these individuals. I'm not sure if they have the capacity to do that, if they're set up to do that. That's not been made clear in the plan. So since there's so many other unknown in your plan, it seems presumable that I'm questioning whether or not you've looked that far.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, I understand. We don't anticipate a big change in Alex other than there will be more patients going there. Their current utilization is about 50%, so they have on any given day about 8 beds of services available, staffed, trained, ready to go. So we don't think that that substantially changes the work that they'll be doing. It'll simply be more fully utilized. And in Wilmer, we've had conversations with the county there, have not talked with the city. We know the city is, in fact, aware of the change. They have not contacted us. But having heard your concern, I'll make sure we reach out to them and make sure that there isn't some untoward event that's coming their way because of our changes.
Other questions? Yes.
As a visitor to your committee.
I'm glad to see you decided to take us up on our invitation to join us at the table.
Madam Chair, I guess my district includes Meadow and the Cambridge Dental, and you know, I've had an opportunity to tour Meadow a number of times, and the thing that concerns me is my understanding is that this is a transitional place where if somebody can't function in a four-person group home because of behaviors, that they go to Meadow, and that they're staffed and designed, and the whole system is built around, you know, addressing those people's concerns. And it's you know, I've seen the bruises on people that work there because, you know, of people that have attacked them. How in the world are they going to be treated in a four-person group home? Where are these people going to go? Are they going to go to St. Peter? That doesn't seem like it's very economical. I see this as a very important part of delivering services as a transitional place. So I'd just like to hear from you guys. Where are these people going to go?
Madam Chair, Senator, the current configuration of Meadow was designed in the mid-90s at a time when our understanding of the community-based system and its capacity to support people was based upon everything we knew then. What we understand now is that many of these folks are coming to us for lack of appropriate psychiatric intervention. Many of these folks are carrying a major mental illness. They're not getting good access to psychiatry in the community, which leads to further problems in where they're living. Likewise, once they come into the Meadow program, ability of the system to move them out when they are stable, when we understand how to better manage their care. So many people come in DeMito and get stuck and spend months and sometimes years beyond. Right now, the average cost of an episode of care at Mito is $1 million upon discharge. It is a very, very expensive model that we can do much better with. It's not a reflection of the folks working there. It's a reflection of really designing a system that is far more responsive to the individuals served. So it is our intent to develop in the long run, to have psychiatric services far more flexible and available. Now that's being done through the Anoka Hospital. That's not the best way to do it, but it's the best way given our current structure. This new model, however, will ensure that people have more ready access to psychiatry and to earlier interventions, earlier upstream, through programs that we offer now. It's referred to as community support services. It's somewhat of a care coordination model, working where that person exists, where they live currently, where they work currently, enhancing the capacity of that system to better support the person. The changes in the MITO program will afford it the opportunity to continue to provide that intensive treatment necessary when they're in that residential setting, but it will also allow a more timely flow through. Intensive foster services at the back door of MITO. We actually have already implemented that model up in Pillager. We operate a 4+1 site that serves individuals who have been stuck in MITO and could really move to that community level of care. So this is, in the end, it's going to be a broader level of services that we operate. It's going to be more responsive to folks so that they don't end up either having to come into a program because of a lack of services earlier on or get stuck someplace because the next level of care isn't immediately available.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Two follow-ups, if I may. I was a county commissioner in Chisago prior to being a senator, and I was on the 5-county mental health. And in that era, that agency struggles to find psychiatrists and to find people to work in the mental health area. And so I'm just seeing that there's a need there that MITO seems to fill. And then also in talking with the city just a few years ago, they were talking about doing land swaps so that they could expand MITO. So the talk of redesigning it and basically downsizing it comes as a pretty big shock to me, because I was on the impression that this was a very successful program for transitioning people and they were thinking of expanding it. So imagine my surprise when I see your report.
Well, I think in fairness to the department, this is an issue that we've been talking with them about for well over a year. You know, it began with the handcuffing situation that we started looking more closely at MITO, and we discovered there was an individual who'd been living there for 14 years. And that was not what this program was designed for. It was to be a transitional program to help meet the needs of people that were needing more intense services than could be offered in their group home situation. My question to you, Mr. Tesmer, is at that time we were suggesting to you that you use the community services component that you have within state-operated services to a greater extent, and that we reduce some of the lengths of stay at MITO. And at that time, you said that it couldn't be done, that you couldn't use that service any more than you were using it. So how is it going to get used more now under this plan? What is going to happen to make it be different than it has been?
Madam Chair, going back to our conversation earlier this week, the psychiatric access service, which also gets to the question of access to psychiatry, we're going to expand, if you will, our on-call psychiatry, and to not just include our psychiatry, but also psychology, behavior analysis, and neuropsychology, which would be specific to folks in the MITO program. so that it has a statewide reach, so that it can be connected virtually through video conferencing technology, so that no matter where the expert is throughout the state, they are available 24 hours a day for consultative services. Those services will provide assessment, evaluation, and triage, as well as admission into state-operated services programs. Attached to that will be the community support services, which is a care coordination early intervention service. That's where we think we'll get a better response. Many of the folks coming into the MEDO program have really ended up in treatment settings that were not well-equipped at all to provide the right level of care. We believe this access service that we'll be developing will help where those people are, the referrals to get the right assessment evaluation and the right diversion into the right level of service, rather than showing up with law enforcement or showing up in emergency departments. So that's essentially how we think the community support service side is going to be more effective in doing what they do now.
So then I would have a follow-up question, and that is the rapid access. Is the savings that were in the GMC bill duplicated in this proposal, and are there any additional savings in this proposal above what are in the GMC bill?
Madam Chair, it would be the intent to roll that into this access service. And in terms of are there more savings, we're designing this entire new system so that it can provide services that are reimbursable. So we believe that there will be savings down the road. It'll be able to collect more dollars than what we currently do through our system. And it will be more effective because people who are assessed earlier when disruptions are occurring and crises are occurring, get better assessment and triage, it'll lessen the likelihood they end up in a hospital or some other intensive treatment setting.
Would the services that are being contemplated in the rapid access portion of the GMC bill be able to collect federal funding that was not projected when that fiscal note was put together?
Madam Chair, in the GAMC bill fiscal note, we assumed an average of 40% reimbursement on those psychiatric access services. I think that's still a pretty good projection, and this isn't going to change that.
So you're just talking about doing more of it as a part of this plan? Or having the same staff we gave you in that bill do this for you instead, or trying to figure out
Madam
how
Chair,
these two things kind of either work together or are side by side, or what's happening here?
Madam Chair, we haven't got to that level of detail. I think at this point we are aware that they need to be joined, but exactly how that staffing would work together, would this be we certainly are not interested in overlapping services and duplicating. It needs to be coordinated. But the psychiatric access service is going to provide a much broader array than what is right now expected in the GAMC bill.
Will it require more staffing then?
The psychiatric access, I'd have to get back with you because I don't recall what our projection was on that service. We already have components that will be rolled in and organized differently. I'm not sure that we're adding additional staff into that model.
Are there other questions? Senator Sharon.
Thank you. This is I know that we have testifiers that you want to hear from, and so I just want to in terms of all of the redesign and the efforts that are made to cost contain in the system, that a few weeks ago I talked with Dr. Sulik about the injuries that are occurring as a result of pressures on the system, overtime, and acceleration of injuries. I really appreciate the response in writing. I don't know if the rest of the committee got it. They probably should. But what I want you to know Mr. Tessner, is that I received communications from the online staff that the conversations and the proposals and ideas for change have included them, and they have appreciated that, but they haven't seen it implemented at the staff level. So I'm asking you to see what that's about and see where the block is between the conversations and the plan and the actual implementation to try to impact and reduce those staff injuries. That's pretty important for me and my district.
Any other questions? Well, why don't we take testimony then? And, we thank you, Mr. Tesmer, for being here today. Dick Derricks, the Minnesota Dental Association. And I think I should just let people who are here to testify know that at the time we scheduled this meeting, we did not know that Senator Marty would be scheduling a meeting at 10 o'clock to hear bills. And some of our members overlap, including myself. So the reason people are not necessarily all here to hear the testimony is not because they're not concerned. And we will make sure they understand the suggestions and the concerns that you do bring to us. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address the department's redesign plan. My name is Dick Derricks. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Dental Association, representing about 3,100 dentists in the state of Minnesota. Within the department's report on the proposal to transform the state-operated chemical and mental health services is the plan to close at least three and probably all five state-operated dental clinics. These clinics serve the most vulnerable of our state's citizens, adults who are permanently disabled, developmentally disabled. In other words, those who should be protected will be abandoned by the Minnesota in terms of dental care in the Minnesota Department of Human Services proposal that's been proposed. This population is the most medically complicated and behaviorally challenging to treat. That's why these five dental clinics exist. Special needs patients need special care, care that's not readily available in just any dental office, as the report wrongly assumes. To think that any dentist can simply step in and provide the type of care, this type of care that's needed for the developmentally disabled patients is not true. And on top of that, the governor's supplemental budget proposes eliminating critical access funding for all private practice dentists so that transitioning to community partners becomes even more impossible. Come May 1st, very soon, a month and a half away, 1,800 developmentally disabled adults now treated in the three clinics, and by the way, I forgot to mention exactly who they are. On May 1st, Fergus Falls, Willmar, and Cambridge will close. And then, theoretically, in about a year, Brainerd and Faribault would close as more planning continues. In the three that would close in just a month and a half, 1,800 developmentally disabled adults now treated in those three clinics will not be able to get the dental care that they depend on to keep them healthy. Because they have tremendous difficulty keeping their teeth clean, for example, they need to have teeth professionally cleaned more than once or twice a year. But their cleanings have been cut to only once or twice a year because of the new adult benefit set for adults. So it's particularly important to keep these dental clinics open so that the comprehensive care that these patients need will be provided. Another example, about 25% of the patients who are developmentally disabled and treated by these clinics require general anesthesia for their care. But general anesthesia is restricted to a very narrow set of opportunities in the new benefit set for adults. And so it'll be next to impossible for oral surgeons and others in the community to provide the care that is needed unless the patient is willing to endure toothache for a long period of time before an appointment can be made and a situation can be created for care in a hospital setting. So these patients are really being abandoned. Fergus Falls, regarding the anesthesia situation, Fergus Falls and Faribault are hospital-based programs dental programs. And given the new restriction on adult benefit set, it is even more important that these clinics remain open so that patients who must be seen under anesthesia can be taken care of. This population is a group that we believe should be given special protection under our laws. Unfortunately, this proposal that's coming forward is really not about the kind of care that the patients need, but about the money and saving money. I urge you to consider how these five dental clinics can be kept open to serve the developmentally disabled and other patients in need. Please don't let these patients be abandoned. These patients need the right level of care. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. I just have one comment about the limited benefit set that was developed for dental care. You know, well, it may not be ideal. We did work with people in the dental community, and it was our effort, A, to save both the dental program for adults, and because the governor had proposed eliminating that last session, and to save the critical access dental program. And then after making the sacrifices that we did, the governor turned around and unallotted critical access dental anyway. So, you know, I'm not sure we would have scaled back the benefits set if we had known that that was going to happen. But here we are, and any suggestions you have about what we can do to get critical access dental back into our budget, or any suggestions you have about further work that needs to be done in the benefits set, we would be certainly looking for your assistance. Are there other questions? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Dr. Dirks, when Dr. Sulik was here earlier, he indicated to us that it was his testimony that individuals in state-operated services would seek their dental care elsewhere in the community. And in light of your testimony, in light of the concerns with general anesthesia, in light of the critical access dental program, I wonder if you would care to comment or give us your professional opinion on that.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, I do believe that that will be very difficult to accomplish. As I was indicating, these are patients who need very special care, not the kind of care that can be provided in a typical dental office. Special training, special facilities for special care is what's needed. And so to work with community partners in these areas of the state, and they serve a very large geographic area. Patients travel a great distance to get to these five dental clinics. It would be very difficult to accomplish.
Other questions? Thank you again.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Jackie Monahan Junick?
Yes. Madam Chair and committee members, we appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm the City Clerk Administrator in the City of Eveleth, and with me today are Paul Fisher, he's our Nursing Home Administrator, and Scott Haas, he's one of our board members. I believe you received my handout that I provided for your meeting, I think it was Tuesday of this week, regarding how the mental health services offered through the state are commingled and so intertwined with a variety of other services and businesses we offer in the City of Eveleth. What we have is the City of Eveleth is a community of about 3,800, 3 hours due north of here, 60 minutes from Duluth and 100 miles from Cloquet. The city owns a facility, a 30,000-square-foot building on 3.2 acres, and in that facility is the Eveleth Fitzgerald Nursing Home, and that is operated by a nonprofit board. They have a 24-bed facility. They have 23 full-time employees and 22 part-time employees. So in addition to being a nursing home, they also offer to the community Meals on Wheels, meals to the state services that are also located in the building. And as you know, the state services, which you've heard from Mr. Tesner, is a 16-bed facility. They currently have a lease with the City of Eveleth. They pay us exactly $8,100 a month. I, in turn, cut a check monthly to the nursing home for about $6,200 for maintenance fees. So the nursing home takes care of all the building maintenance, all the utilities. So it's really a flow through, okay? And any residual money we have, we keep in a fund to help them out when utility costs go up, elevator needs fixing, things, you know, basic building repairs. Also on this 3.2-acre site is a medical dialysis clinic. Okay, it's located in the same building, and they offer dialysis service and also get patients from the nursing home. So that we're all feeding each other. And the need for dialysis in the state and the whole U.S. has expanded. So the city, instead of losing this company to another region of the state, made a deal with this company called Fresenius Medical Care, and we have just built them a 6,000-square-foot building on this campus. Okay, so they're going to relocate to a bigger facility on our campus. That campus building is secured by the taxpayers of the city of Eveleth. And also, again, the intertwining of one facility and needs feeds the other one. Also on our campus is a clinic, a family practice clinic. And this doctor, Dr. Draper, also serves as our medical director. He also has patients that he sees in the nursing home. He sees the patients in the mental health facility. In addition to all these folks located in this area, we have a main street like most small town main streets that's, you know, the ebbs and the flows of the economy have not served all of us well. We have one drugstore with one pharmacist. 30% of his business comes from this cluster of business activities. We have a local business in Virginia, which is just 6 miles from us, that provides us some of our food service. We're half of his business. And the city, as you all know, with an allotment, we don't have the kind of money to continue to help financially support our nursing home. So if the mental health services goes away, the nursing home goes away, the clinic likely at some period of time, the doctor's going to have to go away. Our dialysis folks aren't going to have as many patients. They're going to go away. The city owns the debt on that building. We're under levy limits. LGA's gone down. I don't know how we're going to make it work. And I know you heard this before and you heard Senator Tomasoni talk about it. But I thought seeing us and seeing our folks from the nursing home and being able to answer any of your questions is why we're here.
Sure. Thanks for coming. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Are there questions?
Madam Chair, I don't have a question, but I think that even accentuates what I've been saying. And we did meet with Mr. Tesner yesterday, and it's clear that a compromise solution is quite a ways off, mm-hmm. and that May 1st is a very, very serious deadline. And if I for one am not willing to close the mental health unit on May 1st if there's an alternative to keeping it open for a while longer or keeping it open indefinitely. But I think at some point in time, the fact that this type of a snowballing effect of the closure of the mental health unit in Eveleth that may not have been considered in the plan that we're looking at needs to be seriously considered, and somewhere, somehow, we got to slow down the train that this track is on, because there's some very serious implications of what could possibly happen here, and I mean, we're talking about people's jobs, we're talking about three or four different units in on that particular campus, as well as the businesses that are affiliated with it. So, I'm hoping, Madam Chair, we can come up with a solution that's better than what we're looking at right now.
Senator Tomasoni, I hear you, and I understand. What I'm having difficulty with is the plan we came up with for them last year mm-hmm. been pretty much ignored. So, you know, I'm getting to be a little bit, it's getting to be a little hard for me to exactly figure out how you tell the department what to do in regard to services they offer in a way that they will actually follow what you tell them to do.
Right. Sounds like a money thing to me, Madam Chair, but I'm not sure where that comes from either.
Are there other questions? Thank you again.
Thank
so
you.
Much. Mary Jo George.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Jo George. with the Minnesota Nurses Association. The MNA represents 400 registered nurses working in our mental health system through state-operated services. Joining me today is Linda Rosso, one of our members who will speak directly to the closing on the South Central Crisis Center in Mankato. We're here today to express grave concerns and opposition with DHS's report on transforming our state mental health system. While the intent might be good, we think this plan will decimate services for people with mental illness and result in the loss of many jobs for our state employees, including RNs. What's most troubling, as we've heard today, about this report is the appalling lack of detail and the fast track with which it is on. Many of the proposals are to be developed with a cost or timeline for implementation undefined. Without the detail, it's very difficult for us to truly understand the impact to our nurses and our patients, but we do know it will be very disruptive to the lives of many. The information we're receiving from DHS is coming in a very chaotic manner. Just last week, we learned DHS was revealing the first of the 91 layoffs throughout the state, 23 of which are our RN positions, and we're understanding that many of them are being transferred as soon as April. At this point, we have many, many more questions than answers. Where will the patients be transferred to? What is the transition plan? Where will the cuts to the 200 jobs come from? What are these new levels of psychiatric care centers? We just learned last week, along with you, that the stakeholder meetings are being planned on these defining these levels next week. Given the complex and enormous changes anticipated, we would like to be part of that process. We would like to be named a stakeholder in that process. Other questions we have is, why fix what isn't broken? Both the South Central's Crisis Center and the Evlith program are providing unique services for those communities. We don't understand why we would disrupt those. Instead, why not improve what we already have? Our nurses have been telling us for several years that the CBHHs have not been effective because they've neither been safe for our nurses or the clients that we are serving. Currently, the treatment aspect of these hospitals is compromised, creating an atmosphere of being a crisis unit rather than a treatment unit. While the goal of these hospitals were laudable, we believe many clients are not being served. This is the severely mentally ill, the medically unstable, clients who are aggressive, and those with long-term care needs. However, we do not see where the plan is addressing all of these clients' needs. We do believe redesign should consider the CBHs as outpatient aftercare clients or outpatient aftercare clinics, as crisis units or types of other care. And yet it's ironic that some of the programs that are working are going to be closed in this plan. But again, without the detail, it's very difficult for us to understand if transitioning these CBHHs in Willmar and Wadena makes sense for those communities. So we really do need more information before we can proceed further. Finally, with regard to Anoka, we have 100 RNs that are employed out there. We want to be part of the solution in addressing these changes. We have not been invited as a stakeholder to participate in any planning that's happened or what I should say has not happened. With the looming nursing shortage, we do support the current language in the law that talks about no layoff with the redesign. And so with that, I'd like to hand it over to Linda Rosso to talk about the Mankato facility.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Linda Rosso. I've been a psychiatric registered nurse for 18 years, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Nurses Association and the patients that I serve. And just so you know, I'm not affected by state-operated services. I work in the community hospital and always have. On February 4th, I attended the state-operated services redesign stakeholder meeting in Mankato along with 74 other participants from across our region. This meeting was represented by state-operated services as a request for input into the redesign of state-operated services. The participants were asked what was working, what needed to be changed to better meet the needs of our region. I have 8 pages of notes from the South Central region about what is working well here, or working well in Mankato. The bottom line is that the 10-County Safety Initiative Group is working well and has created working relationships that include the 2 hospitals in the region, which have behavioral health units, private and public providers in the region, nursing, law enforcement, consumers, and county staff, which would include your case managers, your case crisis workers. The South Central Crisis Center was the result of gathering input from all of the members of the Safety Initiative Committee over a two-year period, and I did sit on that committee at that time. Also, the role of the Crisis Center evolved over the 4 years it was in operation. It started out as just being housing people in subacute crisis, but it evolved into much more than that. And the closing of the Crisis Center will be felt most by our patients. Emmanuel St. Joseph's Mayo Health System, as the largest ER in the region, triages many individuals with mental health issues. Prior to the opening of the Crisis Center in 2006, it was the norm for us to transfer 30 to 40 mental health patients from our ER to other facilities in the state, and sometimes out of state. We even sent kids to Sioux Falls. With the opening of the Crisis Center, patients found the right level of care at the right time, closer to home. Currently, ISJ sends an average of 12 patients a month from the hospital, from my behavioral health unit, to the Crisis Center for admission. In 2009, the Crisis Center averaged 29 bridging appointments per month, the majority of which came from ISJ and were for patients who were discharging from my unit and unable to see a provider in an acceptable amount of time. In addition, the ISJ clinics and hospital also referred 20 individuals for 20 urgent care appointments per month. That means they were in crisis, they just needed to see somebody, get medication started or restarted, whatever the case may be. So how has the Crisis Center served our patients? Well, I wanted to give you some examples to put a face on this. We have a patient who no longer needs to be in our hospital behavioral health unit. We have stabilized them, but they're not quite ready to go home. We call the Crisis Center. They can stay there for 1 or 2 days, up to 10 days, to stabilize further and then go home independently. Or we have a patient that's discharging from the hospital and he can't see his provider for med management for 2 to 3 months. They can get scheduled bridging appointments at the Crisis Center, and they're followed by a nurse practitioner or a CNS until they get connected. Or someone shows up in our ER during a crisis who doesn't really meet hospital criteria, the Crisis Center is open to them. They can get an urgent care appointment. I used to be on call, and I would get called at 2 in the morning, go in and have to talk to this individual. Obviously, no other clinics are open at that time. The Crisis Center was open 24/7. I could call the Crisis Center, say, I've got somebody sitting here. Can I get him an appointment? Sometimes I could get him an appointment as early as 9 o'clock that day. So 6 hours later, they can get in to see somebody. At the most, it was 1 or 2 days. If they just needed to talk to somebody, they could go in and talk to professional staff at the Crisis Center who might help them problem solve through the crisis and refer them out to resources in our communities. 77 individuals stayed at the Crisis Center for less than 3 hours. So they went in, got stabilized in 3 hours, and got out again. We also have a situation where we do electroconvulsive therapy, ECTs. We often have to start that as an inpatient. They have to be monitored closely. They usually need 7 to 14 treatments, and they can start those treatments, but maybe they can't go home and finish them as an outpatient because they have nobody to monitor them after the treatment. The Crisis Center worked with us to develop a system whereby a person could have family drop them off. The Crisis Center would get them to and from the ECT treatment, monitor them. The family would pick them up again after work. And that way the patient could go outpatient, not have to sit in the hospital for 2 to 3 weeks getting those treatments. The St. Peter Community Behavioral Health Hospital is not the solution if the services provided by the Crisis Center are no longer available. First, you can't mix subacute populations with acute populations. It's a disservice to both groups. And you also are going to frighten the people who are coming into a subacute area with acutely psychotic, acutely out of control patients. They won't show up. They'll just suffer at home. They won't come. The Community Behavioral Health Hospital is already struggling with unsafe conditions for patients and staff related to an increase in violence and the severity of mental health issues that we're dealing with. Secondly, there's not provider staff to handle a 16-bed operation in St. Peter right now. They've capped at 12 and often only take 8 or 10 patients because they don't have psychiatric coverage. So how are they going to take on more work? And they weren't even told when this was announced in the paper that they were going to do this. They found out reading the newspaper that this was a service they were now going to provide. I would like to know how State Operated Services proposes to expand responsibilities for providers when the staff are already inadequate. Third, there's no available space to handle urgent care or bridging appointments, much less house the subacute population in St. Peter. They'd have to build onto that building, and so where's your savings? We already have a building. We already have staff that are doing this. I want to know if State Operated Services proposes to build more space, and if they add staff or build, then where's their savings? Fourth, the majority of the clients that are served at the Crisis Center are from Mankato. While Mankato has public transportation, we have bus and cab service, and people can actually walk to the Crisis Center, and it's 3 blocks from the hospital. So we have easy access to it ourselves. If the services are switched to St. Peter, which is 10 miles north, there is no public transportation between Mankato and St. Peter. The people I work with don't own cars, they don't drive, and they don't have friends that drive. So how are we going to get them from Mankato to St. Peter for these appointments? And at what cost? Finally, shifting the $17 million savings from state-operated services to a $17 million cost to the counties, community hospitals, or the patients in our region is not a solution either. The bottom line is that the patients are the ones who will pay the price. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Russell,
yes.
Does the drop-in center today collect any federal funds off of their billings? Do you know?
You know, I do, because I don't work there. Mm-hmm. I don't know the answer to that, but I did ask some nurses who work over there, and they believe that part of the issue is that they have not collected the funds or gone after the revenue streams that they could have or maybe should have. But that wasn't up to nursing to do that, so we don't know exactly.
No, I understand. I'm just asking.
Yeah. My understanding is that they did not go after those.
Is it licensed as a clinic?
Senator Berglund, may I offer? Phil Clausen from Blue Earth County can answer those questions. If he was on the list to testify, he could answer them right now for you if you'd like.
Sure, that'd be fine if he wants to come up and join these folks.
Just Madam Chair and committee members, Phil Clausen, Director of Operations, Blue Earth County, Human Services. Just to answer those specific questions, I do have testimony later in the agenda, that there has been a significant concern about billables, and a lot of the services are either reimbursed through third-party payers or medical assistance. In 2009, there were 888 clients served by the Crisis Center, and approximately 10% of those were billed, 73 out of the 888, which is a desperate concern for us because it's not a good business model. Those concerns are very paramount to the fact that now we're closing down this facility. The projected revenues were about $440,000 when it was first set out, and the actual revenues were about $95,000 that were collected. So it is one of the concerns about the efficiency or the efficacy of running the business side of the program at the Crisis Center.
So do you know enough about it to tell me if it could be licensed as a clinic and have, you know, maybe the majority of the services be billable?
Right. The PERTS model that was discussed, ironically enough, does fit the model of the Crisis Center. It is licensed under a Board and Lodge license, which is quite flexible with regard to those those crisis services that can be billed through MA. So there is still a lot of flexibility. I think you hear in my testimony that it's not our belief that we've maximized all the efficiencies that can be seen there, but we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And the licensing is actually aligned very well with the ERTS model and all of those things. Senator Sharon actually commented that we're trying to do a counter proposal, and that proposal will be really to replicate what was there, but maybe using those crisis services and then gaining the revenues back that we've been missing over the last several years.
Well, I'd be very interested in the model you come up with, and unlike the department, if you can give me budget with it, it would be very helpful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mark McAfee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mark McAfee, legislative representative at AFSCME Council 5. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on the redesign of state-operated services. Point one, the redesign plan seems to be driven by economics rather than sound long-range planning. We've had discussion of the impact of the governor's unallotments and refusal to support new revenue. Of course, we had a number of comments by members of the committee here about failure to get all the CBHHs certified by CMS. That also contributed, and those have been open just a few years. Point two, does the redesign improve access and quality of care? I don't need to go back over the fact that it sure doesn't seem to be improving access with respect to dental care, and it's rather uncertain. The promise to have broad geographic access to improve mental health care is not clearly evident as well. Point three, the effort to partner with community health systems, hospitals, mental health centers, primary clinics, health plans, et cetera, it's really just getting underway. Phase two of this plan is at the intention stage, and the execution seems uncertain. The cuts already imposed by the administration through unallotment and the proposed budget cuts coming in this session to county and community mental health services leave a moon-like landscape on which to land this initiative. Partners will need money to collaborate, and this will not be easy to come by. And of course, you discussed earlier the whole battle the chair and others have gone through to get a GMC bill put together. Now it's going to be a tough act to follow. Have there been any handshake deals to date towards phase two? Perhaps not. Perhaps some will come from the community themselves, as you just heard. We appreciate the redesign report describing employees in state-operated services as skilled, compassionate, and dedicated individuals who care for those individuals with the most complex needs in the state. We think that's accurate. Some of those folks are here today, a number of folks that work at MEDO, et cetera. And you've had nurses. I've got some folks here that are professional MAPE employees as well. Some of the folks are worried about losing their jobs, but all of these people are concerned about what happens to the clients they serve. They couldn't stay in these jobs very long if they didn't care about people. Point five, we wish our workers had more of a voice and that their opinions would be more valued. It's true, you heard from Dr. Sulik yesterday, that ideas for cost savings were sought through sort of a, what I would call an electronic suggestion box. Some ideas are forthcoming but remain a secret. Let's get them out on the table. The report says about 1,000 people participated in the stakeholder meetings, but these were not targeted to include workers. Of course, you know, it's possible we may have had a few people that showed up. You just heard that Ms. Rosso went to at least one of the meetings. Employees were consulted little and late. Most discussion, and it's our normal process, comes through labor management meetings with our exclusive representatives informed. Sometimes we get a note that something will be coming ahead, and then normally our people are informed after decisions have been made with little or no chance for input. We think there's a better way. It's not going to happen in the next 5 minutes or the next 5 days, but the better way would be to following quality principles. If employees have security, they're open to change. If they have a voice, they're open to innovation. And I think I would, you know, certainly reiterate what Ms. George of the Nurses Association said. We are concerned about our people, but we do want to be part of the solution as well. Point six, a lot of uncertainties remain. And we've, you know, others have, members here have focused on that, like the PERTs. We don't know yet what the staffing model will be in the new programs. You know, we assume that in PERTs will require less staff than a hospital level, as what has been mentioned by Mr. Tesner. But this whole program seems to be, if you wanted to use a, you know, we represent people in the transportation end. It's like a design-build project. And I hope, you know, our office, not to belabor here, but our office is down by that Wacoota Bridge, and that thing was supposed to be done 3 years ago. It was a design-build project. It had big problems with it. It's delayed 3 years. Yes, it's true. The state collected back $20 or $22 million. But, you know, so when you do it on the fly, it's tough, and especially when you're not sure where the money's at, and then you might cut a few corners, and that's what can happen. So point seven, when DHS moves ahead to phase one, part two, redesign of Mito and Anoka, et cetera, we also, you know, of course, the discussion last year, we'd have to say, I mean, you know, frankly, the focus was heavily on Anoka and on Mito as we went forward. We resisted through much of the session the notion that we would downsize these facilities. But finally, as we got towards the end of the session, became evident this was going forward, and so the no layoff language was put in. When we combine, and we understood it as the notion, also we'll say that this language says individuals working in the community-based services are state employees. So we saw it more as, and the chair is nodding, appreciate it, Madam Chair, that the that there may be, we acknowledge there may be changes. We still think that there's a need, certainly at Mito and Anoka, for, and I think you'll hear from an upcoming testifier, of some of the folks they serve, there's a reason for these facilities. But to the extent to which there can be some redesign, that there'll be an effort to try to move people into other jobs if necessary. And we strongly oppose the governor's proposal to repeal that language until and when something more assuring comes along, especially regarding Mito. Just a couple of other points. DHS is moving ahead with facility closures and layoffs. May have a devastating effect on workers, their families, and communities, and you've already heard some of that. One point I want to make is there's a nationwide trend to push full-time workers into part-time status. This has occurred heavily in DHS so far. And once while we don't have much of a voice in the decisions, once the decisions are made, the HR people are pretty good about saying, okay, here's the deal. They'll send out, consult with our people, they'll send out notices. So under phase one, part one, if I did the math right so far, although Dr. Sulik talked about 82 FTEs being cut, so we may get more information, but so far people have gotten notice that about overall 70 FTEs will be cut, and that affects 93 people. For AFSCME, for example, that would involve 34 FTEs, but it would affect 44 people. And just as one example, when we talk about the crisis center, Mankato. We have five members that work down there. They're all half-time. So we see 2.5 FTEs cut. Those are five people working there. So I just wanted to make that point that if we move ahead, and under the chart that you received yesterday, if we would lay off 220 FTEs, it probably affects close to 300 people. And again, that's just something for you to be aware of. Point nine, there seems to be no detailed plan for phase two and three. You've gone over that. It's, to me, are we flying to the moon or flying blind? It's going to take good, sound, clear communication and planning, and we feel the legislature as well as the governor must have a hand in the decisions made. And then finally, point 10, we know how tough a row it is. You've gone through that with the GMC bill, but we echo what Senator Tomasoni said. To avoid cutting programs, somehow we need revenue. And, of course, you start out with trying to get additional federal or other, you know, third-party funds, and the chair and others you've done. You work so hard to look for every a dime, and we appreciate that. If there's a way to raise any other money to prevent further cuts, you know, we certainly would like that. So I'll stop. And I would just end by saying I think the only hearing that has been more focused and intense this year in this room is probably the discussing lifting the moratorium on nuclear power plants. So thank you.
Thank you. I just want to say that, you know, my frustration about all of this is, you know, if we would have actually been starting last session to talk about how to restructure in a more meaningful way, even than I was able to get the department to do with me, then I believe we could have had a plan where we could have relocated employees into new positions without this sort of crash and burn type of situation. And that's my frustration. You know, my frustration is, you know, last session I felt like I was dragging the whole rest of the world with me, and then it didn't happen anyway. I mean, imagine right now if we had a redesign plan for Anoka that saved 700,000 without layoffs, mm-hmm. how far along we would be toward filling the gap that state-operated services is facing. And I just worry the longer we wait to do things that we should do, the more unsettling it will be to both the employees and the staff and the clients.
Perhaps you're right, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, Mr. McAfee, thank you for your testimony today, and I see many of your members in the room with us today. And I want them particularly to know that when Dr. Sulik was here last, there were lots of questions surrounding the chart that he provided us that you referenced with the bottom line total of 220 FTEs. And I can only say that I think it's fair to say that that's a fluid number. And also when we pressed and asked questions about how is it that we are going to be serving the same number of individuals with 220 less FTEs, that question was largely unanswered. But I think it's important for you to know that the question was asked and it hasn't been forgotten.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, thank you for the comment.
Madam Chair, I have just one last comment, because that's what's very, very frustrating about this whole plan, is that not only are people being laid off, services are not going to be provided to the people that need the services, because there's not going to be the access to the services because places are closing and they're going to be too far away from the services to get the services. And the whole issue of what's going on here is not the right direction. I don't know. Maybe there needs to be a revamping. I don't serve on this committee, and so you all know better than I do. But this solution is problematic right from the get-go. And I don't know how we stop it from happening, but we got to slow this one down for sure, because there's way too many things that are negative. Dr. Stinson has always said that a public sector job is just as valuable as a private sector job. And when you lay people off in the public sector, you still have to take care of them with some kind of public funds because they're on unemployment. But I'll tell you, this isn't going in the right direction, and I want to work with you, Madam Chair, to figure out how we slow the department down and figure out how to do it.
Gentlemen, I'm very sorry, but we have to leave this room at 11, and we have two people that can't come back. So I beg your indulgence while we call on Steve Yund and Phil Clausen.
So thank you for having me here. I appreciate
it. Yes, we are listening to your concerns, Senator.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Steve Yund. I'm a licensed psychologist representing MAPE, really speaking on behalf of the population that Minnesota Extended Treatment Option serves. I've worked with the state of Minnesota for over 30 years and worked with this very vulnerable population for over 31, so I'd like to provide a little context as to the redesign's impact upon this very vulnerable population. As the state of Minnesota was deinstitutionalizing its population of persons with developmental disabilities and related conditions, a few individuals of state-operated services back then had the foresight to look at other states to see what occurred with this population following their deinstitutionalization when the individuals posed a risk to others or themselves. And what they found, and this is some great foresight back then, they found that those with DD and related conditions often ended up in jail, prison, and mental health facilities where their full treatment needs weren't met. And the full treatment needs aspect, I think, is one of my important points I'm going to be hitting up with later. And they were extremely vulnerable. So the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options was created to ensure that this very vulnerable population was afforded the security of commitment and appropriate treatment when they were deemed a risk to public safety or themselves. So since 1999, MEDO has served this population, providing the counties of Minnesota with a safety net, and that's kind of an important aspect, the safety net when a behavioral crisis occurs that results in the community placement of these individuals no longer being a safe option. MEDO has a proven track record of providing treatment for about a 12 to 18 month stay on the average, and I had an opportunity to look at the length of stay in relation to what Mr. Tessner alluded to. Fiscal year 2010, our length of stay currently is 1.5 years, about 18 months. Fiscal year 2009, our length of stay was 0.84 years. So the 9 to perhaps 18-month aspect of our stay, and one important point is that the length of stay so often is driven by the county, not so much in the hands of MEDO, more in the hands of the county and the resources available to the county and the case manager serving the individual. So this treatment at MEDO has occurred across a number of disciplines and it stresses far beyond the psychiatric pharmaceutical interventions as it's highly specialized for this population. The treatment is done in the context, and this is quite important, to Minnesota's consolidated rules in order to augment transition to the private sector providers who operate under those same rules. Integral in the context is this vocational treatment component that MEDO currently has, in that it provides in the root of the individual's behavioral challenges, oftentimes is intertwined within their vocational program. Their vocational program, the stressors involved in, oftentimes you see a MEDO consumer who unfortunately has had to go back to perhaps solely a mental health facility where they're primarily receiving pharmaceutical treatment, perhaps a little bit of individual therapy or something like that. They come back to MEDO, and of course the stressors of going to the vocational program, the work aspect, oftentimes evoke some of the psychiatric symptoms. And so what we found is that all the treatments that we provide in that context are very integral because that's what they're going to when they get out. In addition to the treatment, for the individual, MEDO has provided training for the private providers receiving MEDO discharges in order to facilitate a successful return. MEDO is a 48-bed capacity, and has met or come close to that level of population in the past. We, as of Monday, had 31 consumer beds occupied with an entire building of 12 beds closed and not funded, although we're currently only budgeted for 21 beds. State Operated Services has the proposal before you of changing MEDO to a 16-bed facility, currently serving 31, 16 beds, that safety net isn't going to be there for the counties. And my fear is that this very vulnerable population is not going to be able to be served within the context of the full treatment needs that they do have. This would limit the capacity of MEDO for only 16 campus beds, significantly less than what the current needs are based upon referrals and current population. I know we currently have a number of referrals to us, and we also have been a safety net for special needs services out of St. Peter in order to provide a transition for many of their folks in order to get back into the community. It's also known that this proposal as a PERT would probably affect our staffing ratios, not allow us the vocational program, the context of our treatment and training that we provide, and thus less preparation for those individuals when they go to the community. So if MITO's full, where would these very vulnerable persons go when their private providers can no longer serve them and they present a risk to public safety? I think MITO does a really good job. Our recidivism rate is less than 12%. We do a very good job of working with these individuals. We provide it in the context of what they need when they get out. And it's highly specialized. There's a number of nuances regarding the treatment of persons with developmental disabilities that goes far beyond, as I alluded earlier, the psychiatric pharmaceutical aspect of it. It's not replicated anywhere else in Minnesota where this kind of treatment can be provided that also provides and affords the degree of public safety that MITO currently has. So it's going to leave county case managers without a viable option for their DD client or person with related conditions, leaving that individual vulnerable. In order to advocate for the needs of this special population when they're at risk of themselves or others, the counties need the bed space and the staffing treatment resources that MITO currently provides. The last part may sound corny, but I'm incredibly sincere when I say this. Minnesota really has a glorious history of providing service to those who really need it the most. I've lived in other states. I'm proud of that aspect of Minnesota. So I really don't want us to forget this very special population when the redesign may leave a significant proportion of those without the help who need it most. One other little aspect I failed to allude to was the fact that of the 31 individuals currently at MITO as of Monday, only 17 of those were committed solely as developmentally disabled, did not have a secondary commitment as mentally ill. Where would that population be going should we solely look at a psychiatric type of model for this population? Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Young. You know, the discussions that I had with the department way back over a year ago were more along the lines of downsizing MITO by creating more state-operated SOCs like the one at Pillager to provide for the needs of people that are at MITO that could leave MITO if the counties don't have places for them to come back to, then we should create them, and we should use our staff to do that with. Now, of course, I mean, something like that takes longer than 3 months to accomplish. So, you know, this is part of my frustration is, you know, I knew that we were going to have to do something different with MITO, but getting it to happen before now has been very difficult. And now I think you're right. Now what we have, you know, may not be what we really should be doing to meet the needs of the clients in the best way. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Mr. Klassen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Phil Klassen, Blue Earth County Human Services. My title is Director of Operations. I believe I can summarize my comments, given our time, and tell you more about the categories that I was going to discuss. The first one is that there is a common agreement from counties with state-operated services that we want to get away from the inpatient stays and use least restrictive means as best we can. And so I just wanted to lead off and make sure that's known to your committee, that we're not disagreeable to the idea that we want our consumers to be in those least restrictive settings. So that was a big point that we were going to make. I made the comment when I stepped up before that, ironically, our region, I'm being a little more specific now, when we downsize the RTCs, develop the crisis center, it looks an awful lot like the PERTs. And so we're proud of that. We thought we were on the cutting edge, and we have strong feelings as that have been expressed already that that's a mistake to cut out the piece that we're trying to design into the future. And I think those points have been made, but I did want to just restate those and just say that I think we're at risk of redesigning what we already have And I think it would be a lot smarter not to throw away our resources. The last section I was going to share with your committee is just about the future and some of the bigger, broader concerns. We have heard, just regarding, again, the crisis center, that the redesign was going to serve in the CBHHs only the locus 6, which is the highest level of need. That was the purpose. That was at the core of the redesign. Now we're hearing with the crisis center redesign that they can also maybe do crisis beds at the CBHHs. And then another staff from SOS this last week told us there's no way there's going to be crisis beds at the CBHH. So that confusion that you've heard is part of our deepest concern in our region, and I do think that goes to many regions in Minnesota, that we're getting some of those mixed messages that are certainly concerning as we go forward. And the confusion is on the increase. It's not being worked out. I think our confusion has increased once we got to that decision-making mode. The planning, we were well represented at all the planning sessions. We've had partnership mantra given to us over and over again. We bought into that, and I think especially our consumers now are struggling with this sense of loss. We do have a very vibrant consumer community. Our chair of our region management team is a consumer. At our stakeholders meetings in our community, we have over 200 people show up. They certainly are telling stories about how this was a safety, and this issue of intimidation going to a hospital versus a crisis center is a very big point to that constituency, that they feel that it's more intimidating and the crisis center offered something that was much more flexible. And you did hear some of those descriptors that I think are critical: the bridging appointments for psychiatric, the crisis stabilization for 3 to 12 hours, not 3 to 12 days. We already do all that, and we think that's at great risk. We have an advanced practice nurse that works at the regional treatment center, works at the crisis center, and also works at the community hospital. We share staff. We're doing a lot of the things already that are prescribed in phase 2 and 3 of this plan. So we just wanted your committee to know that when it gets to the budget philosophy, if least restrictive care is the smart way to go, then we need to make sure that we're not cutting those out of our services now and trying to make a CBHH one size fits all. It will not work, and we have strong conviction about that. We're left with a lot of raw emotion. Our consumers certainly feel like they've been left in a big gap, and we're trying to work through that. And again, as stated, we're going to counter propose some options that we think bring in some of those business models and the revenues that we talked about earlier, to try to do this right, and we certainly hope to continue to save a partnership with SOS. So we're active in that, and we just wanted to make sure that the concerns from our community and especially our consumers are made known to your committee.
And just one other request: when you report back to me, Senator Sharon and Mr. Klassen, about the meeting that you're having, if you can let me know if it looks like it might be viable for you to become licensed as an ERTS, and how long you think that would take for you to actually accomplish that.
Yes, Madam Chair, I will just give you a preliminary response to that, is that we would try to engage current ERTS providers who have that licensure. So that is part of our plan, to look at that option, that the people that are in that business, that know this business. We do think there's a disconnect between the actual trenches and sometimes where things are decided at the state, and we think this is a classic example of that. We have providers in our community that have those licenses already, and we believe we could hit the ground running. In talking to some of those people already, they say within a month they could, you know, stand this back up again, and we would address the licensure issue with that too, but we will certainly report back to you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Any other questions?
Senator Berglund, I know you want to close, but I just want to say that I'm glad you had a chance to hear from some of the people from our district. We really have, through the Adult Mental Health Initiative, the Children's Mental Health Initiative, both which are going to fall apart because of funding problems, models that have been trying to achieve the cost savings and bridging between health and human services, and it's all being collapsed because of decisions that are made about trying to draw down federal dollars rather than integrate health and human services dollars. So there's models here for us to learn from, and I hope that we can bring them forward for the state to take a look at.
Well, I think braiding funding is also an important component of things.
It is.
But it's harder for us to do that at the state level than it is at the local level.
Let me be clear. I'm talking about, for example, the Children's Mental Health Initiative, where there's divisions between what is health care and then what might be human service dollars that, if expended, would save in the health care side of the deal. That's where we're finding these silos and these difficulties in terms of you decide a system based on these funding streams rather than on how to provide the service.
Right, Senator,
that in
but
the
I
end
think what I'm saying to you is that is part of the role of counties to braid funding. And it's harder for us to do it for them at the state level. I mean, I've looked into it. You know, I'm willing to go down that road again if we have to, but really and truly, it's so much easier, more easily done at the state level than at the local
the county level. County
level. Senator Laurie?
And then real quick, I think it's important that we reiterate one more time what is really at the core of the frustration that we're having is that we gave a very clear legislative mandate for a manageable restructuring that was going to save money, that had broad buy-in with everybody, that was going to serve the clients, and it got turned into, at the department, something that was much broader, that wasn't manageable, that didn't have the buy-in, that doesn't appear that it's going to be able to work in the time frame that we have to move this, and we're not going to be able to recognize the savings. And at the same time, we're not going to get this little discrete piece that we did ask to have done. So we're at cross purposes, and this is very frustrating, and I'd just like to make sure that that's crystal clear to everybody. So thank you for your comments.
And for those who were not able to testify, we will schedule another time. We do want to hear from everybody. So thank you, everyone, for being here today, and the meeting is adjourned.
Then you'd have to add
absolutely
to that besides.
I'm right now, sorry.